Welcome to the Science Podcast for June 22nd, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, measuring influence in social media, Curiosity's upcoming landing on Mars, and a special issue on controversial bird flu research.
But if I was a terrorist or somebody wanted to cause trouble, I wouldn't do it this way.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
For nearly 8 months, a media storm has surrounded two controversial research papers about H5N1 influenza, or bird flu. In the wild, this virus has been observed to pass from birds to humans, but not between humans, a characteristic that has limited its ability to generate a pandemic. The research papers in question, submitted to Science and Nature, explain how to synthesize a droplet-transmissible H5N1 strain that can pass between mammals, which raised biosecurity alarms and stoked an ongoing international debate about research with the potential for dangerous misuse. This week, Science publishes one of those reports as part of a special issue that also includes additional research, news, and commentary on that debate. Science's editor-in-chief, Bruce Alberts, who wrote the introduction to the issue, spoke with me about what the controversy means for future biomedical research and publishing. Here's an excerpt of our discussion.
The idea is that the virus is not a major problem for humans now because it dies rapidly in air. That is, it doesn't survive in droplets when you sneeze or in aerosols. And so the question is, how difficult is it for this virus to mutate to a form that could be dangerous to humans, that is, one that would spread in air? And we had no idea what the answer was. So these two studies, done independently, use the best model we have for humans for the flu virus, which is ferrets, and tried to answer the question, how many mutations does it take, and therefore how dangerous is this virus in the future to human populations?
And then these two papers actually publish the specific mutations that would yield this flu airborne in humans.
So each paper discovered, through different means, ways of mutating the virus so that it can survive in air much better than the normal H5N1 virus does. So with these specific mutations in the two different experiments, that virus is on the way to becoming dangerous for humans. Important part of the controversy was, well, is this really able to spread effectively through air as is needed to cause human pandemics? And there is some real doubt as to whether the virus, although it can survive in air, whether it survives well enough to actually be dangerous to humans.
So what are the arguments for publishing these studies in full for the entire scientific community to have access to? Why did the authors want this to be available for everyone?
Well, always the argument about science is the more people who know about what's been discovered by other scientists, the more minds there are thinking and creating creative new interventions to get at whatever problem we're studying. In this case, to try to design protection against this kind of mutation happening in nature, or either to prevent that mutation from happening or to screen effectively for bird populations that have almost evolved to this state. So the argument for publishing it openly is that you never know which scientists where will have a method or an idea that will advance our knowledge that will protect humans. And if you provide this knowledge only to a few scientists, you greatly reduce the chance that further advances could be made.
But even so, the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity, the NSABB, recommended redacting these papers, not publishing them in full. So what was their reasoning for that, for actually restricting what information was made public and what information wasn't?
This science is a good example of what we call dual-use research. As I just stated, it can be used for good for other scientists to build on and design protective measures that will reduce the chance of a pandemic arising from H5N1 virus and killing large numbers of humans. But the other side of the dual use issue is that having such knowledge in principle would allow somebody with bad motivations, terrorists, or just somebody who's very unhappy working in a lab and wants to cause some great commotion, it could empower them to produce a virus that might be dangerous. So the dual-use side of this is, what is the balance between the probability of somebody using it for harm and the probability of somebody using it for good? And this kind of decision is a very difficult one. And this is why the NSABB was established following the recommendations of a study from the National Academy of Sciences in 2003 to make these kinds of judgments. And very importantly, this committee is partly composed of distinguished scientists with expertise in microbiology in this case, but also by people with security backgrounds who know about some of the security issues. And so this committee is the closest thing we have to a Supreme Court to make these kinds of value judgments. And this was the first time, after looking at many other papers, it was the first time they ruled in this direction. Previously, they've always ruled because of the balance and advantage to openness to publish in full.
Now, how do we identify dual-use research in the first place? I mean, this kind of study, you know, may very clearly have good and bad potential outcomes, but there are some that lie more along sort of an unclear, fuzzy line. How do we identify good and bad outcomes of research?
The question you asked was that proposed and addressed by the Academy Committee in a report that was chaired by the distinguished scientist at MIT, Jerry Fink, and therefore is sometimes called the Fink Report. And this committee, again, had something like 7 or 8 members of the National Academy of Sciences and an equal number of security people on it. And, of course, this was set up shortly after 9/11 with the anthrax scare and so on. The first question was, can we ever imagine a time when we might not want to publish something openly? And if so, under what circumstances? And this committee, importantly, decided, yes, we could foresee a time in certain kinds of experiments we would not want to publish openly. And they laid out 7 different kinds of, they called categories of concern, specific kinds of experiments, such as making a virus more dangerous to the human population. So as editor-in-chief of science, and I had been president of the Academy when that previous report was prepared, my major point in responding to the requests from the NSABB was to support the NSABB mechanism. First of all, it's the best mechanism we could imagine for making these decisions. Second of all, without an NSABB, we'd be back where we were before the Fink Report, which is a situation which was very uncomfortable for me personally when I was president of the Academy, where people from the government would come and try to prevent publication of papers that shouldn't be prevented from publication. Hmm. People who were largely from a security background and tended to underestimate the advantage of publication and overestimate the dangers of publication. So I felt, and my colleague at Nature, Phil Campbell, the editor-in-chief of Nature magazine, we both felt that we should try to respond positively to the request from the NSABB simply to support the NSABB mechanism.
So what eventually led to the NSABB's reversal of opinion?
Well,
you know, what eventually led them to give you the green light?
I'm not really privy to all the details. I did discover during all this time that the NSABB, in making its original decision, never had an in-person meeting with the authors. They never had a detailed discussion of the authors with what exactly in the paper. So one of the reasons why the NSABB met to reconsider was, of course, the WHO meeting, which pointed out that the NSABB had a responsibility to deal with international issues, not just national ones. And the second reason was that it came out at the WHO meeting by talking to the authors who were there, unlike at the NSABB meeting, that some of the data had been misinterpreted, in particular, how efficiently this virus spread from animal to animal. And it was now realized that the spread was much less effective than it is for the normal pandemic flu viruses that we know about, seasonal flu viruses. And second of all, there was a misconception that the ferrets who had been infected by being in a cage next to another ferret and therefore had received the virus in some kind of droplet or aerosol, they had thought that those ferrets not only got infected, but that they died. And in fact, none of the ferrets died. So on the one hand, the spread is less effective than the NSABB had thought. And secondly, the lethality of the virus was being misinterpreted initially in the original experiment.
How interesting. So the potential for, you know, quote-unquote evildoers to take advantage of this information was, of course, one of the bigger worries for biosecurity officials in the first place. So in the end, how is that being addressed? Can anything actually be done to prevent this research from getting into the wrong hands?
Of course not. I mean, now that anybody has information about the exact mutations that cause this difference. But if I was a terrorist or somebody wanted to cause trouble, I wouldn't do it this way because it's now clear that the virus doesn't spread very well. It's not that lethal. We thought it was much more lethal to humans originally than it probably is. And, you know, it's not a weapon that you can control. And finally, there are only very few places that could do this kind of reverse genetic engineering that would be needed to make this virus. You have to be very sophisticated. So my own belief is that if you really want to do some harm, there are many easier ways to do it.
That was Bruce Alberts, Science's editor-in-chief, talking about controversial flu research published this week in Science. You can find an extended version of the interview on our H5N1 special issue page at www.sciencebag.org/special/H5N1.
On Facebook, like likes like. But how strongly I like things that my friends like depends not only on how similar we are, but also on how influential they are and how susceptible I am. In a report this week, Sinan Aral and Dylan Walker measure influence in a social network by tapping into data from a Facebook app. I spoke with Aral about how to harness the power of this influence to improve public health.
The paper presents a general method for measuring influence and susceptibility to influence in a social network. And this method can then be used to identify influential and susceptible individuals in that network. The important contribution of the method is that it avoids known biases in current methods by employing message randomization. So, for example, one bias is homophily bias. Homophily simply means that birds of a feather flock together, that we tend to make friends with people who are like ourselves. So if two friends adopt a product or behavior, one right after the other, current methods have a hard time distinguishing whether it's because the first friend influenced the second friend, or rather that just because they're friends, they simply have similar preferences and thus tend to behave similarly. Mm-hmm. So we use this method to measure influence and susceptibility in the adoption of a commercial movie application on Facebook among 1.3 million people. And we found that, for example, men are more influential than women, that women influence men more than they influence other women, that older users are more influential and less susceptible to influence than younger users, and that married people, for example, are the least susceptible to influence in the decision to adopt the product that we studied.
Well, let's talk a little bit about why you did this study. Why is it important to figure out who's influencing who and what influencers are like?
Yeah, sure. So finding influentials is all the rage at the moment. You have companies like Clout that are trying to put influence scores on people in social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, mm-hmm. primarily so that brands can target them with advertising to help spread the adoption of their products and services. And that kind of viral advertising is big business. But the goal of bringing science to this task is actually much broader and farther reaching than that. Understanding social contagion or how behaviors spread in a social network is critical to the success of intervention strategies designed to promote or contain any behavior in a population. So policymakers, parents, managers, they've all been interested in, for example, whether children's peers influence their education outcomes or whether mm-hmm. workers' colleagues influence their productivity or whether happiness, obesity, and smoking are contagious and whether risky behaviors like drug abuse spread as a result of peer-to-peer influence. We're also interested, for example, not just in products, but whether we can spread behaviors like HIV testing through peer referral as easily as we can spread behaviors like product adoption.
Wow, so there's a lot of different places this kind of information could apply.
Yes.
What are some of the theories about susceptibility influence?
So there's been a bit of a debate raging over the past several decades about the influentials hypothesis. So some argue that influential individuals catalyze the diffusion of opinions, behaviors, innovations, and products in a society. But others contend that it's not a small number of influential individuals, but rather the prevalence of susceptible individuals that catalyze social contagions past the tipping point. Our work shows that it's actually the joint distribution of both influence and susceptibility in the network, which together determine the pattern of the contagion and someone's importance to the propagation of the behavior in a population. What matters, for example, is whether influentials are surrounded by susceptibles and whether influentials and susceptibles tend to cluster together or not.
What about people who are influential? Can they also be susceptible?
While we found that there were clearly some people who are more influential than others, in fact, we found that influence and susceptibility tend to trade off, that people who were more influential tended not to be susceptible, and people who were more susceptible tended not to be influential. We found almost no one who was both highly influential and highly susceptible at the same time. But again, not only were there some people who were clearly more influential than others, but some, not all, but some of these highly influential people were themselves connected to other highly influential people, giving them the potential to be quote-unquote super spreaders. And I say potential there because we have to remember that these people also tend to be less susceptible, so their ultimate impact on diffusion will be a complex dynamic process involving all of these factors and varying by context.
Interesting. Let's delve a little bit into the method here.
Sure.
You used a Facebook app, which
yes.
Most people hopefully are pretty familiar with, but maybe you could describe that a little bit and give us a little information about the kind of data that you collected.
Yes, absolutely. So this was a commercial Facebook application, which was about movies. Basically, the application allowed people to rate movies, buy movie tickets, read about directors and actors, and share their individual ratings and discussions of movies with their friends. And the Facebook application asked users to opt into sharing their data on the adoption of the product, some basic demographic information, and their social graph data, who their friends are. Mm-hmm. And the application also obviously respected the user's own privacy settings in Facebook. And then using these three types of data, we were able to estimate our model.
So you looked at their friends and also their own personal demographic information?
That's correct.
So what kind of demographic information proved to be important?
Yeah, so for instance, we looked at gender, we looked at age, we looked at relationship status, whether you're single, in a relationship, engaged, married, or you say that it's complicated, quote unquote. And then we also looked at things like whether you and your peer who had the greater relationship commitment. So we were able to estimate, for instance, not only whether men were influential in general or women were influential in general, but were women more influential over women or more influential over men?
In this case, influence meant that once they adopted this program and their friends were alerted about it, then the friends would take it up as well.
Exactly. Facebook enables messaging that tells your friends about your behavior. So it might say, hey, you know, Sinan has just adopted this movie application. You might be interested. And so we use data on the friend's adoption of the application after having been notified of their friend's adoption as our method for estimating influence.
How do these findings compare with what we know about influence in offline networks?
My intuition is that this is going to mirror what happens in offline social networks. But the science of influence is really just beginning. Although there's lots of historical work on interpersonal influence and persuasion that actually informed our study, we've never had access to this type of data, time-stamped micro-level behavior for networks of tens or hundreds of millions of individuals interacting in real time before the last couple of years. We need a lot more work on whether, for instance, influence is a generalizable characteristic of people or rather whether it varies by topic, by behavior or product. We also need more research on whether influence in online social networks mirrors influence in offline social networks.
So at the beginning of the interview, you talked a little bit about how these kinds of findings could be useful for public health or other campaigns interested in influencing human behavior. How do you see what you found now? How would that work?
When you combine estimates of influence with estimates of susceptibility, the joint distributions of these things in the population with the natural tendency for different types of people to adopt a given behavior, then you can devise very precise and accurate targeting strategies that can optimize or maximize the peer referral or spread of a behavior in a social network. For example, we're applying the same science to test if we can promote positive social and health behaviors like HIV testing. Mm-hmm. People tend to know their friends' interests and so know which people in their social networks they should go to or would benefit from the promotion of a certain behavior or idea or product. And people tend to trust their friends more than they do government billboards or mm-hmm. corporate advertising. And so these types of methods, as the science gets more mature, could be really important to intervention strategies to promote or contain positive and negative behaviors in populations. Everything from tolerance and exercise to reductions in obesity or smoking or dirty needle sharing. You may be familiar with advertisements like friends don't let friends drive drunk. Mm-hmm. These types of early advertising, which was broadcast advertising, et cetera, tend to point us towards what in the future could be much more sophisticated peer-to-peer referral strategies.
Well, Sanan Aral, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Sanan Aral and Dylan Walker write about influence in an online network in this week's Science.
If you were to send 3 tons of sensitive machinery over 9 million miles, how would you ensure that it lands softly? For NASA, this isn't just a hypothetical question. With over $2.5 billion riding on a new Mars rover named Curiosity, they have to get the answer right the first time. Science News writer Richard Kerr spoke with me about Curiosity's highly anticipated arrival on the Red Planet.
NASA is sending its next rover to Mars, and it's going to be a big one. And that's necessitating some changes in the way they land things on Mars. They've beefed up their landing system, innovated with an entirely new way of putting something on the surface of Mars. And the stakes are fairly high because this new way of landing on Mars is going to be essential, if it's successful, to future exploration and even essential to sending humans to Mars.
So we've sent rovers to Mars before. What makes this particular landing, the rover Curiosity, different and so much more challenging than the others?
Well, NASA has set 2 goals for itself. One is getting this very large and very capable rover called Curiosity onto the surface of Mars. And the heavier something is, the more difficult it is to land on Mars. Mm. The other is that they're going to try to deliver it more accurately on the surface of Mars than anything has been delivered before.
What do you mean by more accurately?
Well, in the past, the best they've been able to do is target an area 100 kilometers long. And engineers promise that it will land somewhere in that 100-kilometer-long landing ellipse. This time, they're targeting a 20-kilometer-long landing ellipse.
I envision sending these rovers as sort of lobbing something just off the Earth and hoping that it'll reach somewhere within this bullseye.
Well, in the past, it's been almost like that. They point it just before it reaches the atmosphere, upper atmosphere of Mars, and then it's on its own.
So how have other rovers landed on Mars in the past? How have they landed safely?
2 ways. NASA's done it successfully 6 times. Some of those times they've landed much like you might have seen in a 1950s sci-fi movie, rockets blasting downward, slowing the vehicle until it just gently touches down the surface. Others have bounced onto Mars inside what looks like a beach ball, generally called the airbag system for landing on Mars. So it literally bounces across the landscape until it comes to a stop and then extricates itself from the airbags.
Walk me through then how Curiosity is going to land on Mars. If it's so much bigger, has so much more sensitive machinery, how is it going to make its soft landing?
Well, it's so much bigger. It comes in at 3.3 tons clammed inside of its entry vehicle just before it enters the atmosphere. So that's too big, too heavy for these previous systems. They just weren't going to work. So it's going to appear much the same initially. The bullet-like entry vehicle enters the atmosphere, slows down from the drag from the atmosphere with fiery debris coming off the heat shield. Then it'll slow enough, well, down to Mach 2 anyway, for the parachute to come out. And all the vehicles have had parachutes come out in the past. This one's going to be a bit bigger and sturdier. But then the rover, encased in this last bit of machinery, will drop out of the bottom and start firing its rockets. Also pretty standard. But then the rover itself is going to be lowered on a cable beneath the rocket platform. And it's going to put its own six wheels out, and then it will be gently, according to plan, deposited on the surface, landing on its own wheels, ready to roll off. Then the cable will be cut, and that rocket platform will fly away out of harm's way.
So it's basically being lowered on this cable by an airborne crane.
It's the sky crane approach. Most scientists who have seen the NASA video showing you how this is going to work, they usually use words like nervous, scary. It is fairly scary looking, but the NASA engineers, most of whom are at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, are confident that they've done everything humanly possible to make sure this goes off well at Mars, which is going to happen on the 6th of August.
So what is at this very narrow target that this rover is being sent to? What's its primary objective in this mission?
Well, they wanted to, naturally enough, look at the most interesting geology that they could. And the prime goal of the mission is to search out evidence for environments on early Mars where life might have gotten started or been living billions of years ago. And so they surveyed the planet from orbit, and there was a particularly interesting spot, the eroded side of a mound in the middle of Gale Crater. And it's long looked appealing to the scientists. The Gale Crater rocks appear to be layer upon layer of different kinds of rocks, some of them obviously altered by water, and water has been a big theme with NASA at Mars. If you got water, maybe you had life. And so they want to land precisely enough that they can drive over and take a look at these rocks that might have been laid down while something was living in Gale Crater.
Great. Very exciting. Dick Kerr, thank you so much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Carrie.
Richard Kerr writes about the Curiosity rover's innovative landing gear in a News Focus this week. To see the video simulation that Kerr mentioned, go to www.scim.ag/rovervideo.
Finally today, we've got David Grimm, online news editor of Science. He's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. Okay, Dave, first up we have some ancient turtles caught in a normally private activity.
Right. They were caught in a very private moment, Sarah. This is a moment that happened tens of millions of years ago in what is now called the Messel Pit, which is a fossil site in west central Germany. It used to be a lake that a lot of creatures ranging in size from rodents to pygmy horses used to hang out around, and a lot of their fossils have been found there. What's interesting about these turtle fossils, this is an aquatic species of turtle, is that there were 9 pairs of turtles caught, for lack of a better word, in the act, copulating, and they were fossilized that way. And this is actually the first time this has ever been caught in vertebrates.
Wow. So how can they tell what's going on in with a fossil record like this?
It's a good question. Turns out the male and females don't look alike. The males are actually smaller. They have longer tails. So that allowed the researchers to say, hey, these are actually pairs of males and females we're looking at. And actually, in most of the pairs, the male is very close to the female. And actually, in a couple of the pairs, the male appears to have his tail wrapped below the female's shell, which is sort of classic turtle mating position. So this is all pretty strong evidence that these guys were actually having sex at the time that they died.
And so how did they die?
Well, that's the other mystery. You know, how did they die and why did they die at this particularly intimate moment? And there's been a lot of hypotheses. Researchers have said, well, maybe there was some toxic algal blooms in the lake and that can kill creatures. But researchers really haven't seen any fossil evidence of that. So what they think may be the case is that the surface waters of the lake were fine, but something was going on in the depths of the lake, which is where these turtles were found. There was maybe some toxin down there, or the water was maybe very oxygen poor down there. And what happens when turtles mate is they start mating at the surface, but as they mate, they actually start to sink. And so what the researchers think happened is that these guys were mating, they sunk to the bottom where there was little to no oxygen, and then they died while they were having sex, and they were preserved like that for all time.
That's pretty amazing. And what can scientists learn about that time from these fossils?
Well, they're actually learning a lot about sort of the ecosystem of this lake just by studying the turtles and by getting a sort of a better sense of what the conditions were in this area of the world during the time. So it's not just sort of shedding light on some ancient sex acts, but also giving us a little sense of what the environment looked like that these turtles copulated in.
Wow. All right. Next up, we have a story about elephants and their very large characteristics. In this case, their long gestation time for their offspring.
Right. Well, from mating to pregnancy, elephants have the longest gestation period of any mammal. It's 22 months. The females are pregnant for 22 months. So
that's like being pregnant with a toddler.
Yeah. It's like being pregnant with a toddler. Exactly. So that's pretty remarkable. What's also remarkable is that elephants form multiple corpus luteums, and these are temporary glands that control hormone levels during pregnancy, and they make sure that the female maintains the correct balance of hormones to ensure that her body, you know, is doing everything it's supposed to be doing to support the growing baby. Human beings and most other mammals only make one of these. Elephants have as many as 11. So there's a lot of unusual stuff going on during an elephant pregnancy. And in this new study, researchers wanted to sort of really follow an elephant pregnancy for the first time.
So people have these lutea and elephants have them, but what are they made of? Where do they come from?
In humans, actually most mammals, they form from a single egg follicle in the ovary during each menstrual cycle. The luteum produces progesterone, which in turn promotes a thickening of the endometrium. And if an egg is fertilized, the corpus luteum goes on to sort of maintain all the hormonal balance that needs to be maintained during a pregnancy.
So it makes sense that the elephant would have more than one to kind of support a longer pregnancy.
Exactly. If you're talking about being pregnant for a really long period of time and you really got to sort of keep these hormone levels in check, you might want more than one of these
things. But where do they come from?
And the way the researchers figured that out was they actually followed 17 elephants with blood tests and ultrasound scans. They actually had to do the ultrasound scans rectally and had to train the elephants not to kick them.
Wow.
So this is not the easiest study in the world. First thing they found was that the elephants formed on average about 5 corpora lutea during each menstrual cycle. And unlike in other mammals where one of these is derived from an egg-laying follicle, the elephants had that, but they also had corpus lutea sprouting out from other separate follicles in different points of the reproductive cycle. So it's not just forming in the same way it forms in their mammals. And they say that having this many follicles really sort of seems to help the elephants stay pregnant for as long as they stay pregnant. One of the reasons I hypothesize that the elephants stay pregnant for so long is that baby elephants are actually born not like us, pretty helpless and pretty useless when we're born. Actually, baby elephants are pretty with it when they're born. They are born with complex cognitive skills, and they're actually able to immediately sense how to survive in their environment and interact with the herd right out of the womb. This long gestation cycle really benefits them, and now researchers sort of have a better idea of how it happens.
Really interesting. Last up, we have a story about how a computer program can evolve music out of noise.
Right, Sarah. So what this study is really about is how you get from something that sounds like this. To something that sounds like this. Hopefully you can detect there's a pretty major difference there. That first one's pretty hard to listen to. That second one, not exactly Mozart. You know, it's a fairly pleasant melody. All of this comes about from a program called Darwin Tunes, which is sort of an effort by a group of researchers to see if there's a way to apply the forces of natural selection, as we think about in evolution, to music. The idea being that if you start out with a bunch of random bits of music that aren't really harmonious, like you heard in that first audio example, can you over time, by selecting for more harmonious samples and recombining them, create something that's much more pleasant to listen to?
And how are they deciding what's more harmonious or less harmonious?
Well, that's the key of the study. When they first started using this program, it was just one person that would get in there with Darwin Tunes and said, okay, I like this better, I don't like this, and the program would sort of recombine based on what that one person liked. But the researchers said that's really not indicative of how music evolves in the real world. You know, it's often not just sort of a composer in a room just sort of hashing out a melody. A lot of times, the composer sort of drawing on other influences or maybe even getting feedback from an audience or collaborators, and that's really shaping the music. And the researchers really wanted to sort of plug that dynamic into Darwin Tunes. And the way they did it was they actually had about 7,000 people input their like or loathing of these audio clips online. And the participants sort of rated the audio clips on a 5-point scale. And then sort of in a musical take on survival of the fittest, the high-scoring loops went on to pair up with other high-scoring loops, and they sort of replicated. You can sort of think about maybe like genes replicating, and each resulting generation was again rated for how pleasant it was, and then those again replicated and combined. And so over, you know, thousands of generations, you go from something that's pretty cacophonous to something that's fairly melodious.
One thing that I noticed is that it's not exactly a work of genius, what comes out of this process.
Right. That second clip, like I said, wasn't exactly Mozart. And what the researchers noticed is that the music did not get infinitely better. It sort of reached a point that was fairly pleasing, and it sort of plateaued at that point. So they're not saying you're going to be able to use Darwin Tunes to create the next great classical masterpiece. But the researchers say that, you know, if they try to make the process a little less random, because it's not really completely random in the natural world. You have two parents, you have sort of a more constrained gene pool than you would have here where you have thousands of people, you know, exerting their influence. And the researchers also say actually by boosting the number of users, they could actually maybe also make these compositions a little bit more complex than they are right now. And if you want to get involved in the project, there's actually a link to cast your own vote on the Darwin Tunes website. You can check out our site for the details on that.
Cool. But it sounds like they'll always need a little inspiration.
Exactly.
So what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got an item about a vanished toad that has reappeared in Sri Lanka. Also a story about how cheetahs outpace greyhounds. For Science Insider, we've got a story about why U.S. students are struggling with reasoning skills. Also a natural history mystery. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about the science of organ transplantation. Why does our body reject foreign organs, and what can we do to stop it? And next week's Science Live is about the increasing number of PhDs in the workforce. Are we training too many graduate students? So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave. David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the June 22nd, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.